This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. I remember one of the songs my twins listened to just a few years ago, "When you help someone smaller, it makes you feel taller." Clergy urge us to be generous and do good deeds, but what does science say about altruism and helping others? Dr. Stephen Post has done extensive research on love and doing good. Dr. Post is a bioethics professor at Case Western Reserve University, president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, and author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People. He has shown that the fountain of youth has been inside us all the time. And while becoming a more loving, giving person won't make you live forever, his research shows that it will help you live a longer, healthier, happier life. In the first part of the show, we'll look at love and happiness and what makes a good life. In the second part of the show, we'll get specific about how to live a more loving life. Dr. Post, welcome.
It's a delight to be on with you. Thanks a lot for having me. I know it's always a delight, Michael, to be in touch with folks in the Columbus area.
Well, thank you. And you're just up at Cleveland, about 120 miles away.
That's exactly right.
Dr. Post, how did you get to know Sir John Templeton and found the Institute of Unlimited Love?
I met Sir John in about 1993, I believe. And at that time, he was probably about 80 years old. I met him at a conference outside of Leesburg, Virginia, and we started talking about the power of love. He happened to be raised in rural Tennessee. He was a Presbyterian. He had a sense of what he called agape love, a love that doesn't count costs and that extends to everybody without exception, the kind of love that, you know, gets people down to New Orleans after Katrina. So we became friends and over the years, and then in 2001, he sent me a wonderful fact. I was sitting here in my office and at the medical school at Case Western. The fact said, roughly, Stephen, we need to have an institute that studies not just human disease and deficit, but really the greatest human assets, like gratitude and forgiveness and optimism, but most importantly, love. And he said, we should call the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love. So I had a little bit of trepidation about that because I could be misinterpreted. So I thought, you know, Sir John, maybe we should call the Institute for Creative Altruism. It sounded a little more sciencey, but also it's kind of dry and arid and not very appealing. So he faxed back, no, I think Unlimited Love, X million dollars. And I faxed back, Sir John, I love that language. It jumps right off.
I bet you were in shock.
Well, I was happy. You know, he's a great guy. He's 95 now. He's one of the real impressive people I've ever known. He's a very generous, kind guy, very successful, of course, but he's humble and he never criticizes anybody. And the main concern is that we learn more about these spiritual strengths, awe, forgiveness, kindness, compassion, love, gratitude, optimism, faith, and recognize how these kinds of states and emotions can enhance our lives.
So he's a great role model for what you teach and what you research.
Yeah, he really is. I think he's a magnificent human being.
Now, I bet you get an awful lot of jokes about the Institute name.
A little bit here and there, but not much. I remember I was doing a week of lectures at the Chautauqua Institution in August of 2005. I received a cell phone call from Michael Feldman's producer. Turned out, down to Cleveland to the Palace Theater on September 17th to do the show, and he wanted me on for 45 minutes as his special guest. So I said, fine. And then about a week before September 17th, I listened to his show for the first time, and I realized he could be a little bit mischievous.
Oh, yes.
I took a walk in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, by the Chagrin River, and I just sort of prayerfully asked the creator, if you will, okay, what's Michael Feldman going to ask me? And it occurred to me, as it would probably occur to anybody with half a brain, he's going to ask me, well, Dr. Post, what kind of love are we talking about? So I actually got down there in the morning at the Palace Theater, and I had that one response rehearsed, nothing else, because you don't want to rehearse a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me, I sat down, and the first thing came out of his mouth, "Well, Dr. Post, what kind of love are we talking about here?" And I said, "Michael, the kind of love that gets people down to New Orleans after Katrina."
Oh, great answer.
"The kind of love that makes our otherwise competent medical students the real healers that we all want. The kind of love parents have for their kids that God's supposed to have for us all. And Michael, the kind of love that I think all these people here in the Palace Theater have for you." At which point they all stood up and applauded, and he spent the next hour asking people all around the country what their experiences of unconditional love were like. And he only got a line when he asked me why a certain species of prairie voles, like prairie dogs, are monogamous. And that was okay, because I had the answer.
So for one program anyway, you transformed it. And Michael Feldman's program is kind of the radio equivalent of the John Daly Show.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Oh, he's a nice guy. He's the king of chit-chat humor.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they call it small talk humor, and he's very good at it. But you have to be on your toes.
Of the research that you've conducted or the Institute's conducted, what's been your favorite study?
Probably the two I like most. One follows a research project that actually began in the late 1920s at Berkeley in California. The researchers with our Institute went back and remined all that data and re-interviewed the remaining 200 adolescents who have been followed every 10 years by teams of psychologists and doctors since that time. Turns out that the third or so of those youngsters way back when who identified a kind of altruistic purpose in life, like to use my talents to contribute to the lives of others, over their entire lifetimes, they're shielded from depression and physical illnesses, especially cardiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, you know, now that they're mainly in their 90s, they're actually outliving by a bit their peers. And so in that sense, you have a very reliable study that shows that a generous heart and a generous attitude toward life, toward contributing to the people around us, tends to create a kind of a protective halo that follows us our whole life long.
And how interesting that we have the metaphor of the heart lasting longer.
Well, that's right. That's right, exactly. That's true. That's a great metaphor. You know, the other study I like looked at AA, you know, Alcoholics
mm-hmm.
Anonymous. Most of your listeners are going to know about that, I think. You know, that began in Akron, Ohio, actually, in like 1932
oh, that's right.
or so. Yeah, and that's why the Stan Hewlett Hall, the carriage house, is now an AA museum, because that's where Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, who was an alcoholic surgeon at Akron General Hospital, got together. The 12th step is to reach out and help someone else with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Affirm them, love them, listen, be empathic, and possibly sponsor them into AA as well. So it turns out that if a person goes dry at day one, they typically go to medical treatment for, say, 4 weeks. Then they're referred to AA. If you look at them 1 year later from the point they went dry,
mm-hmm.
if they fulfilled the 12th step, there are other steps too. I mean, you have to sort of let go and let God,
mm-hmm.
and you have to make amends and apologies of a sincere sort to people you've offended. There are other steps there, but the point is that if you fulfilled all the steps, including the 12th step, you have a 40% recovery rate. If you do everything else but the 12th step, which is to say you don't reach out to help someone else with alcoholism, you have only a 22% recovery rate.
So you double your odds.
You double your odds of recovering at 1 year if you reach out and help someone else with alcoholism, yeah.
Impressive. Back at the first study, longitudinal research, where we study people over time, is the gold standard of research. To what extent can we conclude from that study that the altruism caused a longer life as opposed to was just a correlation?
That's an interesting point. Studies like that have to be viewed in a larger context. If you look at a number of studies we have on the brain, for example, we know that when people even make decisions to contribute to charities, a part of the brain gets active, the mesolimbic pathway,
mm-hmm.
that's associated with joy and that doles out feel-good chemicals. The helper's high, just a few hours of volunteerism a week, and or any particular experience of going down to the soup kitchen, and half of people report a high feeling, which is endorphin-based, and 40% report feeling calm, happy, you know, 13% feel a relief of aches and pains, etc. When you look at all these things, there are so many studies together. What they do is point toward causality. At a certain level, it's very difficult to finally prove causality. There are a lot of mortality studies on older adults, like Duke University followed 900 older adults, 55 and older, for 15 years, and it found that the ones who were in the top quarter on optimism had a 23% lower mortality rate than those who were in the lower quadrant, who were pessimists. Actually, 7 studies pointing out that older adults who do low threshold volunteering have reduced mortality rates as well. So what I would say is that when you put it all together, one of the maxims of social science is that when a whole lot of different methodologies point toward the same conclusion, which is to say that it's good to be good and we do get a certain kind of benefit from generous emotions, that's great. On the causality thing, too, I would say that look at the alternatives. There have been studies. I don't know if your readers or listeners may be aware of the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is this battery of several hundred questions. Goes back to the 1940s. It's used widely to do personality assessment.
I've done thousands and thousands of them, yes.
Yeah, so there was a guy, a guy named Redford Williams, a cardiologist from Duke University, went back, this is in the 1990s, and he picked out the 27 questions that he most thought captured hostility. So quickly agitated, hot-tempered, raging feeling, uncaring, unforgiving, ungrateful, and so forth. And he called this the hostility scale, which is Googleable, actually.
Then it's real. I mean.
Oh, yeah, then it's real. And then what he did was he looked at people who had taken the Minnesota test in 1950 when they were 25 years old. He followed their mortality rates until they were 50. And it turns out that the ones who were in the upper quadrant on hostility had a death rate of about 20% by age 50. And those who were in the lower quadrant had a death rate of 2%. So you could say then that hostility and anger kills. Anger, in short bursts, is self-protective and necessary. But if that's left on in an extended way, it's very stressful and very hurtful to the body. It's kind of like acid on metal.
This is really amazing because so much of social science research is just correlational and just a snapshot and questionable. But here we have quite a few longitudinal studies and then the conversion of the antithesis and the brain research. This is as convincing as it gets in the social sciences.
As it gets. I mean, Michael, I think that's it. I mean, nice study, David McClellan at Harvard. He was a big gun and he had to watch movies of Mother Teresa. And then the controls watched emotionally neutral movies, potato peeling or whatever. And the ones who watched Mother Teresa had elevated salivary immunoglobulin A, which is a standard way of checking for the strength of the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So then he split that group in half, and he had half of them meditate or dwell or imagine or visualize or contemplate warm giving from the heart. And they maintain that elevation immune system strength, whereas those who didn't go through that mental exercise went back down to baseline. So even dwelling on, he concluded, giving love is good for us. And I think what happens is you get a relief from the preoccupation with the self and the anxieties and problems of the self when you turn to others. You know, the first time I'm aware of in world literature where the idea of love your neighbor comes up is in a passage from the Hebrew Bible, Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. But what it says actually is, do not seek vengeance or bear a grudge, but love your neighbor as yourself. And I think the point there is that love is a powerful enough emotion and activity, and it's both, so that it can push aside these very deep-seated vengeful emotions, and that's really what we need to be in.
The study you mentioned, or studies like it, any idea how long that benefit for the immune system remains?
Stop their visualization, it goes down to baseline. But it suggests that when you're involved in helping people from the heart, it's going to make you happier. And to the extent that you're not overwhelmed, of course, you know, that's always a caveat. You know, it's going to probably be healthier. A report a couple of years ago in the American Journal of Public Health indicated that hot-tempered men and people who ruminate, who are unforgiving, have higher rates of upper respiratory infection than others do.
So Archie Bunker's in trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You want to recognize that certain kinds of emotions keep us in a state of stress, and that's a bad thing. If you're pumping cortisol into the system, you're converting a lot of metabolites into fatty acids that get caught up in your vascular system. The volume of your lymphatic system is lessened. And so there are a lot of factors here and physiological models to explain these things. And so when I do unto others, you know, not insincerely, I mean genuinely, for sincere reasons, a byproduct or a side effect is typically going to be a kind of inner emotional homeostasis that frees me up from a lot of negative emotions and anxieties and just lets me love others. And in so doing, I'm also helping myself.
The psychologist Csikszentmihalyi talked about flow states, where we get so absorbed in something that we lose track of time. To what extent is the altruism you're talking about a flow state?
Well, I think it is a flow state, and it better be a flow state. I mean, it needs to be a practice in life that you work with, you know, around the clock to the extent that you can. Get up in the morning and visualize caring and loving the people you'll encounter. Try to make your first little activity of the day, your first interaction, a loving one. Make an effort to do this in a coherent and a consistent manner so that you don't have a lot of abrupt deviation in moments of bitterness and rage. And be careful to take into account folks who may seem to be of little consequence to you. So that's the barista or the person pumping gas at British Petroleum. Just make a point of being relatively consistent and do stay in the flow, and it is a kind of engagement. But in the end, as Marty Seligman points out, the guru of happiness research, Seligman says there's three forms of happiness. One is just hedonic pleasure. But he says that's not as powerful a form of happiness or as sustainable as the engaged life. That's where he brings in Csikszentmihalyi and the notion of flow. When you're really doing something that uses your talents and you're really into it, it's like the world just disappears. So that's called the engaged life, pleasant life, the engaged life. And then the meaningful life is the life where you feel that what you're doing is noble and purposeful and important and helpful to the world.
So it's not half an hour on your schedule, it's a way of life.
It's a way of life. And what's interesting is that in the happiness research, the people who have a kind of nobility of purpose actually do better on the hedonic stuff because they take more pleasure in the simple gifts, the smell of a log burning on a fireplace. They don't need to push the envelope and do everything and anything to the point where they wind up dying at age 25 in some ball of fire and are on the front page of the National Enquirer.
What's the relationship between the research you're doing and Martin Seligman's learned optimism and authentic happiness and the whole field of positive psychology?
Well, I like Marty Seligman. In fact, we were both on the panel together and had breakfast in Sydney, Australia, about a week ago at the third international conference, Happiness and Its Causes. That was fun. This guy from Harvard, it was fun. Yeah, that's right. Hey, watch out. Happiness is no laughing matter, right? Tal Ben-Sahar and then the William James professor at Harvard, Dan Gilbert, was there, and Mathieu Ricard was there. It was really a really interesting group. And there were about 4,000 folk in the audience. Marty, he's a close friend, and I consider what I'm doing to be an aspect of positive psychology. But I think that whereas Marty is very strictly secular, I think partly because he's creating a new field, you know, there are always going to be critics who think that you can only study deficit and disease. So he likes to keep it pretty simple, straightforward. But I like to, in addition to good science, I like to raise questions about, you know, speculative questions about the nature of the universe, whether love goes with or against the grain of the universe, and all those kinds of things. And I'm one who's much more open to facilitating dialogues across science and spiritual thought.
There's been an explosion of books on happiness. We've got Dalai Lama's book, we've got Authentic Happiness, How of Happiness, Stumbling on Happiness, Secret of Happiness, Gross National Happiness, Happiness is a Choice, Happiness is a Problem. Are we obsessed with happiness, and is asking the question, how can I be happier, the wrong question?
Yeah, it is, because we should really be asking how we can contribute to the lives of the people around us. And happiness is primarily, not entirely, but for the most part, a byproduct of such a life. I think when we ask ourselves, how can I be happy, what can I do to make myself happy, we're really kind of making a mistake. It's probably better to kind of avoid the question and recognize that most of happiness is indirect. When we live meaningful and noble lives that contribute to the world around us, in general, we're going to be happier than would otherwise be the case.
So we got to trust the force.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, the Stumbling on Happiness book, Dan Gilbert's book, is not that good a book. And Marty Seligman rightfully criticizes it. Gilbert says, for example, having children doesn't make you happy. Okay, well, if you only measure happiness the way he does, which is in terms of hedonic pleasures, sure, you know, when you've got a baby to worry about and the diapers and the late nights, you're not out imbibing a good wine. It takes a little bit of time away from physical intimacy and the like. It's not an experience that we think of in terms of hedonic pleasure. In fact, on the contrary, it's very demanding. But if you think about happiness more broadly, certainly you having kids and engaging as parents is a kind of a flow thing at times, but meaning is key. We find that our lives gain meaning when we participate in the procreative process and we bring new life into the world. So, you know, if you look at happiness more broadly, then, you know, what Gilbert is talking about doesn't really apply, at least not to most people.
Yeah, I found Stumbling on Happiness was an interesting intellectual discussion, but at the end, I was left very frustrated. In some ways, it was kind of pessimistic. One of my beliefs is never go with pessimism.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So that's not, you know, the pick of the litter amongst those books. But, you know, some of them are pretty silly, and a lot of them don't define happiness very carefully. So a lot of this stuff is based on self-report happiness, but at some point, we do need to ask ourselves, what is happiness? And that's not just a sort of a quaint philosophical question, but it really is pretty profound, because there's a lot of unhappiness in the world around us, and we need to figure out, beyond a certain threshold, material wealth doesn't make people happier. It does to an extent when you're no longer poor and stressed out about where your next meal's coming from. But beyond that, you know, the extra designer jeans and the extra cars and houses do not make us happier. A study from Harvard University came out in the March 30th volume of Science magazine, looked at happiness and income. Actually, income did not predict happiness. What predicted happiness was whether you used your income to do things for others. Then they looked at executives with bonuses, and the ones who used their bonuses to do helpful things for others were happier. Then they gave college students $20 bills, and the ones who came back and had used it to help others were much happier than those who spent it on themselves.
What a wonderful way to research it.
Yeah.
You're listening to Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. In a minute, we'll get back with Dr. Post and discussing how the system works and how you can use this to help you live longer, healthier, and happier. I have a free offer for listeners. In my book, Defy Aging, I gave the research, the theory, and the how-to for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I know a lot of people don't read books, so I distilled it down into 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, which has just 2 pages a week of practical steps you can take. But I found that some people had unconscious objections that were keeping them from implementing the attitudes, the beliefs, and the coping skills that would foster their health and longevity. So I drew upon my 30-some years of hypnosis experience and study to develop Reverse Aging, a remarkable set of 6 anti-aging hypnosis CDs. Any hypnotist can get you very relaxed and comfortable and make suggestions. The difference between exceptional hypnosis is knowing what to say and how to say it in the suggestions. I also teamed up with John David Jones, a remarkable keyboardist who's worked with Del Reese, Gladys Knight, Les Brown, and a lot of celebrities. His original 4-track keyboard music hugs my words. Most people listen to the CDs when they're going to sleep, and it helps them drift off to sleep, and a lot of people have told me it has helped with insomnia. My gift to you is a free MP3 of the first CD. To get yours, just give me some feedback on the program. Send an email to radio@agelesslifestyles.com and give a comment on the program and your name, and I'll get you your free MP3 down. You'll find the Anti-Aging Hypnosis MP3 extremely relaxing and a great way to drift off to sleep at night, effortlessly absorbing anti-aging attitudes, beliefs, and coping skills Again, to get yours, just send your comments in the program with your name to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Getting back to our show now, Dr. Post is professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland and author of Why Good Things Happen to Good People. The website for his book is www.whygoodthingshappen.com, just whygoodthingshappen.com. It's available on that website, at Amazon, and in most bookstores. And Dr. Post, I'd like to comment that this isn't a tome of research, although there's some research, very readable research integrated in it. It's more of a step-by-step guide for how to become healthier and happier and to live longer. And it's not a book that I would read cover to cover. It's more the kind that you'd be well to read 5 pages a day and mull over it and implement it rather than speed through it.
The book's got nice stories, and it's got some very easily managed scientific presentations on the benefits of a generous life. But more to the point, it's about the different modulations or expressions of love in our day-to-day lives. There's a chapter on creativity. Some people are able to use their creative gifts to help others, and that really is their sort of modus operandi. You know, a cancer driver, survivor here who every day goes into the hospital at university hospitals and knits and crochets for people and their families. That's what she does. Other people are attentive listeners. That's what they do well. Some people are compassionate. They respond profoundly to suffering, and they remediate it in remarkable ways. So there are a lot of different ways of giving. For some people, it's what I call celebration, where we are very good at appreciating the people around us and literally celebrating them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Love is affirming the significance, the happiness, the security of the people around us. And, you know, when that happiness and security mean as much to us as our own happiness and security, we really do love that person. But we love people when their happiness and security are concerns generally, and we're not coolly indifferent. The thing is, you know, human needs are very different. Sometimes people need forgiveness, and so there's a chapter on forgiveness because that's a modulation of love. Love takes many different forms, like spokes on a wheel, but the core is always love. It has how-to and has little tests so that you can self-assess in all these different domains of giving.
I'm going to back up a bit and get the big picture. You divided love and altruism into 4 different domains and then 10 different areas. And so what we end up with is dozens and dozens of different ways that people can be more loving or more generous. Most books on love just focus on one aspect of love. How did you come up with the 4 domains?
I've been working on that for many, many years. You know, I wrote a book called The Spheres of Love about 20 years ago. It was more philosophical. But I think if you look at the literature, people talk about family love and friendship love, or they talk about love of the neediest and so forth. But the bottom line is that in everyday life, I get up in the morning. I guess I'm a pretty typical guy. I got a wife and some kids. That matters. And then I may have a friend I meet at the coffee shop for breakfast or something. And then I got students and colleagues. And then I work clinically in the Alzheimer's world pretty heavily. And then I do a lot of things around the world, public speaking and so forth, and consulting. So most of us, you have all these different domains or areas or spheres of love in our lives. And the key thing is how to balance them and to know how to draw boundaries and not to be overwhelmed, stressed out, in fact, by doing too much. Taking seriously the kind of biological reality of the people who are given to us right next to us right now in this moment, and having confidence that we can help them in various ways as they can help us, but not to be insular and always to lean outward toward a shared or a common humanity.
So if someone looked at your system and said, I want to do more of this, I want to be a more loving, altruistic person, would they be better off starting with their strengths or their weaknesses or just whatever appeals to them?
Start with your strengths. We all have gifts. You know, part of happiness is engagement with those gifts. So we have them for a reason. They should be our strengths. Now, on the other hand, if you've got real remedial areas where you're terribly weak, it would be nice to kind of straighten up in those a bit, you know. But the thing about love, you know, it's not just for, some people just say, well, it's all compassion. Well, it's not, because a lot of people we meet every day are not suffering, and so compassion is really a love in response to suffering. But, hey, I mean, oftentimes, like, we have a graduation coming up on Sunday, everybody's going to be celebrating their loved ones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so love can also be expressed in terms of appreciation and celebration. Or love can be expressed in terms of what I call carefrontation, honestly confronting someone whose behaviors are destructive or self-destructive, but still, you know, hanging on to that relationship through the power of love. So it's all sorts of different ways of being loving, and it depends a lot on your strengths and also on what the people around you need.
Using celebration as an example, you talked about the importance of ritual and how that's often slipped away from a lot of our lives. Having more rituals in our lives, observing birthdays and anniversaries and graduations and occasions and making a big deal of them is a way of loving people.
Sure it is. Sure it is. You know, there's a book by Charles Dickens called Bleak House, where you know, a woman is constantly pouring the paper or through the newspaper articles in the Times of London in Dickens' era, the Victorian era, rightfully reading about people starving in Africa, and that's important. I mean, we ought to be concerned about those people and more concerned. But on the other hand, she's got these two wonderful daughters, and she doesn't celebrate anything in their lives. They don't have birthday cakes, nothing appreciative and celebratory there.
Mm-hmm.
So part of affirming in love the people around us is just taking the time to be with them and to celebrate the kind of events and benchmarks their lives. I'm going Sunday to celebrate a lot of students I know. If I don't do that, they are going to be upset about it.
Each of the 10 areas, you have a quiz to go with it. How does the quiz help us become healthier and happier?
Well, the quiz is a self-assessment tool, so you can pick up some of your strengths, and you should maintain those, and possibly if you can have a vocation or a career that allows you to operationalize those strengths, hey, that's perfect, you know. But on the other hand, you know, you may have some areas where you're really very low on attentive listening or very low on forgiveness, and I would recommend that you work a little bit in those areas and try to at least get them up to speed. Not that you're going to become everybody's model, but at least try to take care of some of the major deficiencies that you might have.
Could you distinguish between how you see spiritual versus religious versus people who just organically do this stuff but may not be spiritual or religious?
Oh, absolutely. Some people are deeply loving, and some of this is genetic, by the way. Studies indicating that there are people who are simply, you know, more predisposed to generous, altruistic, giving behavior than others.
Mm-hmm.
Dalai Lama says, "I don't really care what you believe, but I care that you become compassionate." And I think that that's a pretty powerful argument. I guess spirituality needs to be viewed largely in terms of the cultivation of a set of positive emotions. Again, awe, forgiveness, gratitude, love, compassion, faith, hope, and so forth. And the question is, you know, are those emotions just part of human nature, part of evolved human nature, or something more? Well, I think they are part of our evolved human nature, but my own sense is that in spiritual experiences, those emotions can be elevated or enlivened or extended in ways that we might not be able to do independently.
So spiritual or religious paths would be ways of enhancing if it fits for you, and some people they may find it doesn't fit, and some people just thrive with it.
Yeah, I think that religion at its best is organized spirituality. But, you know, religion sometimes gets pretty barren, and so people distinguish spirituality from religion. But, you know, religion at its best, meaningful worship and ritual, is a way of enhancing individual spirituality in a very legitimate way. I think people are a little ambivalent about religions these days because sometimes they bring out the very best in people and sometimes the very worst. And so we need to, I think, encourage the religious traditions to find within their own resources emphases on a shared humanity, for example. And one of the problems today is that get people who really do have a sense of a shared or common humanity. You know, Rabin loved everybody, got killed by a right-wing Jewish-type person. Sadat got the Nobel Prize after Camp David. He loved everybody. Gets killed by an Egyptian jihadist. Mrs. Bhutto was very cosmopolitan, I think had a deep love for all humanity. She gets killed pretty much by an Al-Qaeda person. The list goes on. Gandhi loved everybody, Muslims, Jews, Christians, and so forth, secularists, and he gets killed by a fanatic Hindu. So one of the problems we face is that people feel threatened because they only love some small fragment of humanity and not the whole of humanity. So those guys in those airplanes that flew into the World Trade Center were altruists in a sense. They gave up their lives for what they've considered to be a holy cause, although misguided, I think. But what's interesting is that their altruism was very destructive because it was centered on one particular fragment of humanity, and then everybody else didn't count.
It's a fascinating perspective that it's just a matter of too narrow a focus that distinguishes a terrorist from a Mother Teresa.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'd love to see what you're teaching in the schools. Some of your research that you cited that more altruistic teenagers are happier and less at risk for suicide. How do we get this kind of thing in the school system or with teenagers?
Oh. Well, the Montessori system for the younger kids does a pretty good job already. I mean, mm-hmm. You've got a lot of, it's a philosophy that appeals to our essence of goodness, and the older kids help the younger kids do pro-social things. Generous, kind behavior is modeled, taken seriously, rewarded, praised, acknowledged, and all of that. So we need systems that really do that. That was actually in Vancouver last week at the request of the Dalai Lama Center there, where they're building a new school for the education of the heart. We need to not just educate for the mind, but educate for the heart, and that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but I think it means educate people in these so-called spiritual emotions that I've referred to, forgiveness, gratitude, love, hope, and the like, awe, tranquility. And we need to have practice and activities around these kinds of strengths. We need to journal around them in the curriculum. We need to let people write papers where they go out and do something that is forgiving or do something that expresses gratitude or love, and then they maybe ask themselves, well, how would this particular philosopher or this social scientist think about what I did? And then maybe, do I agree with what that person would think about what I did? So we need to really build this into the curriculums. And even in the medical schools, we need to be very careful about, especially the clerkships, when people after the second year get out in the clinical environments.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have clerkship directors and residents who really model this kind of behavior and expect it and reward it. And it has to go right up through life. Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts are good. Assisted living programs, hospices, in every area of life, corporations. There's no reason why corporations can't be based on love leadership models, and some of them are, in fact. Bottom line, by the way, is that you get better worker retention in workplaces where there is compassion and forgiveness.
I especially like your Montessori example because my fear, and probably a lot of other people's fear, is that this could easily become politically correct and jam down some kids' throats if people don't do it the right way. But Montessori has provided just such a beautiful way of doing this without an agenda.
Yeah, without an agenda and without being browbeating or authoritarian. But without being permissive, in the sense that you want to be authoritative. I mean, you want to have expectations about behavior that are clearly stated. People deviate from not time to get rough and mean-spirited, but simply to engage people creatively around the golden rule and such things, and to make that part of the social climate.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not kind of coercive, authoritarian, browbeating type endeavor. But rather, it's about creating a social milieu, a social situation that brings out the best in us with a degree of freedom and respect that we all need.
One of your areas of altruism was humor, and you said that's an area that you're particularly fond of. How does humor play into helping people be more altruistic? I think a lot of people think of some rather cruel comedians.
Well, that's true. Nasty, distasteful, mean-spirited humor is a bad thing, but you know, you look at a guy like Bob Hope, who was from Cleveland originally, by the way, and he spent most of his life traveling to war zones around the world, using uplifting, clean, tasteful humor in appropriate ways to help the people around him so that they could reframe their view on the future and be more positive and more hopeful.
Wonderful example, and I think he lived to 100, didn't he?
Lived to be 100, and that's a nice point. So did George Burns, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that love has to be dry and barren. No, ideally not. In the medieval period, caritas, which was the Latin word for unselfish love to virtue, was very closely associated with hilaritas, hilarity. So I often use in my talks very tasteful jokes. So, you know, what did the Zen Buddhist say to the hot dog vendor? Make me one with everything. When we laugh, when we feel mirthful, typically we are less stressed, and there are a lot of studies on lowered stress hormones, elevated immune function, better psychological health when we can laugh. One of the unfortunate realities of life is that when we can't laugh with the people around us, we really don't have much love for. It's hard to imagine loving people if you can't laugh with them from time to time. I got a son who asked me, hey, Dad, what kind of girl should I marry? I say, Andrew, I don't know, but make sure you guys can laugh.
Not the usual parental advice.
Yeah, but but that's good advice, right?
Yes.
You can't laugh with your special friend as a spouse for, you know, ideally the rest of your life. You've got a real problem.
Any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
The book is doing well, and it's an important book. Like you said, the website is Why Good Things Happen. The Institute is www.unlimitedloveinstitute.com. It's located in Cleveland, Ohio. Been a lot of fun working with it. Takes courage.
Does the Institute put on seminars for the public?
Well, I do a lot of public speaking, but I don't actually organize educational programs, but that may be coming.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Dr. Post, thank you so much. I just love your work, and the book is just fabulous and a great guide for helping people be more loving and more altruistic.
Thanks, Michael, and good luck to you and to everybody in your listening audience.
Thank you. I like to leave listeners with a baby step or two on how to live a longer, healthier, happier life. Our culture seems to become obsessed with how to be happier. It's easy to get seduced into thinking that happiness comes from more success or more material goods. The quality of our life is often dictated by the quality of questions we ask ourselves. And there's usually one question that's at the forefront of our questions. For a lot of people, this is, what do I need to do to be happier? And I'd suggest, and Dr. Post suggested, that that's the wrong question. Instead, we should be asking ourselves, what do I need to do to live a better life and be a better person? The payoff may not be immediate, but as we just saw, there's a lot of high-quality research suggesting that the benefits include living longer, healthier, and happier. As Dr. Post indicated, and I've believed for many years, happiness evolves from living a good life, evolves being absorbed in having a purpose in life and following that purpose. A closely related baby step is to have a firm belief that once you have enough money to take care of the basics of life, money doesn't buy happiness. Dr. Post cited some fascinating research that was how executives spent their money that determined how happy they were. One of my favorite research studies comes from David Myers, who tracked from 1960 to 2000 what percentage of Americans said they were very happy. During that time period, the percentage stayed very constant over the years at 30%. Meanwhile, per capita income more than doubled. Thus, even with twice the per capita income that's adjusted for inflation, there was not a budge in the percentage of Americans that rated themselves very happy. The reason I'm making an issue of this is that we have so much advertising seducing us into thinking that, oh, if only I had a newer car, a bigger house, more clothes, ate out at nicer restaurants, then I'd be happy. We need to be very clear in our minds that while there's nothing wrong with these things and it's nice to have them, it's not going to buy us happiness. The road to happiness is paved with literally good deeds and with love. Checking our email, we had a listener write about last week's program with Don Waltrup, color and image consultant. She wrote, Dr. Bricky, Ms. Waltrup's interview was fascinating, but her comments on changing her wardrobe every 5 years seemed terribly wasteful. Do you agree with this? I struggled with this a lot. Dawn works primarily with executives and professionals in very competitive positions. For them, it's often a matter of whether they keep their jobs or get promotions or earn bonuses. So for them, it's worth the investment. For some people, it's very important to be in fashion and to be up to date. And for them, the good feelings that go with looking their very best makes it worthwhile. However, for most of us, it's a compromise. We need to consider our lifestyle, what our goals are, and how important it is relative to how the money could be otherwise spent, and particularly considering today's program, whether it could be spent for more altruistic purposes. If you spend a lot of your time in a pair of jeans, you certainly don't need a new pair of jeans every few years, even if a new style comes along. If the jeans look good on you, they fit well, the color looks good for you, no problem. So it's a very personal decision, but I certainly agree with the listener that cost and the waste should be a serious consideration. This is Dr. Michael Berkey with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier. And by the way, remember to send me an email with your comments on the program and your name to get your free MP3 download of my anti-aging hypnosis CD. You'll love it.